Now on Radio 2, the next installment in our series of Ian Fleming's James Bond stories. Damian Lewis reads part one of The Property of a Lady.
It was a hot day in early June. James Bond put down the dark grey chalk pencil that was the marker for the dockets routed to the 00 section and took off his coat. He didn't take the trouble to get up and drape the coat over the hanger Mary Goodnight had suspended, at her own cost, damn women, behind the door of his connecting office. He dropped the coat on the floor. There was no reason to keep the coat immaculate, the creases tidy. There was no sign of any work to be done. The signals had for weeks been routine. The daily top secret sitrep yawned. Bond hated these periods of vacuum. The harsh burr of the telephone sprayed into the room. Bond picked up the receiver. Sir? Sir. He got up from his chair, put on the coat, and at the same time put on his mind. He walked through into the connecting office and resisted the impulse to ruffle up the inviting nape of Mary Goodnight's golden neck. He walked out into the close carpeted corridor, along to the lift, and up to the eighth. Miss Moneypenny's expression conveyed nothing. It usually conveyed something, if she knew something. Bond registered that this was going to be some kind of a routine job, a bore, and he adjusted his entrance through that fateful door accordingly. There was a visitor, a stranger. He sat on M's left. M said stiffly, "Dr. Fanshawe, I don't think you've met Commander Bond of my research department." Bond was used to these euphemisms. He held out his hand. Fanshawe rose, briefly touched Bond's hand, and sat quickly down. He was middle-aged, well-fed and clothed rather foppishly, four-buttoned coat, a pearl pin and a heavy silk cravat, spotless wing collar. Bond summed him up as something literary, a critic perhaps, a bachelor, possibly with homosexual tendencies. M said, "Dr. Fanshawe is a noted authority on antique jewellery. He is advisor to HM Customs and to the CID on such things. He has, in fact, been referred to me by our friends at MI5. It is in connection with our Miss Freudenstein." Bond raised his eyebrows. Maria Freudenstein was a secret agent working for the Soviet KGB in the heart of the Secret Service. She was in a watertight compartment of it that had been created especially for her, and her duties were confined to operating the Purple Cipher, a cipher which had also been created especially for her. 6 times a day, she was responsible for dispatching lengthy sitreps in this cipher to the CIA in Washington. These messages were an ingenious mixture of true fact, harmless disclosures, and an occasional nugget of the grossest misinformation. Freudenstein, who had been known to be a Soviet agent when she was taken into the service, had been allowed to steal the key to the Purple Cipher with the intention that the Russians should have access to these sitreps and thus, when appropriate, be fed false information. It was a highly secret operation which had been running smoothly for 3 years. And if Freudenstein also picked up canteen gossip at headquarters, that was a necessary risk. She was not attractive enough to form liaisons which could be a security risk. Fanshawe looked quickly at Bond and then away again. He addressed his boots. "You see, it's like this, Commander. You've heard of a man called Fabergé, no doubt. Famous Russian jeweller. Made fabulous Easter eggs for the Tsar before the revolution. That was indeed one of his specialities. He made many other exquisite pieces. Recently there entered this country the most amazing specimen of all, the so-called Emerald Sphere, a work hitherto known only from a sketch by the great man himself. This treasure arrived by registered post from Paris, addressed to this woman, Maria Freudenstein." "Nice little present. Might I ask how you learned of it, Doctor?" "The declared value of the package was £100,000. This was unusual. There are methods of opening such packages clandestinely. I immediately recognised the Emerald Sphere, but what I found of particular interest was the accompanying document which gave, in Russian and French, the provenance of this priceless object." Fanshawe gestured towards a photostat. "The sphere was commissioned by Miss Freudenstein's grandfather in 1917. On his death in 1918, it passed to his brother and thence, in 1950, to Miss Freudenstein's mother. She left Russia as a child and lived in Paris. It seems that she died last year and that some executor has now forwarded the sphere to its rightful owner, Miss Freudenstein. Last month, Sotheby's announced that they would auction the piece, described as the property of a lady, a week from today. I made discreet inquiries and met the lady, who confirmed the rather unlikely story contained in the provenance. It was then that I learned she worked for the Ministry of Defence. It crossed my rather suspicious mind that it was, to say the least, odd that a junior clerk engaged on sensitive duties should suddenly receive a gift to the value of £100,000 or more from abroad. M broke in. Thank you, Doctor. You have examined this emerald ball thing, and you pronounce it genuine? Certainly. So does Mr. Snowman of Wartsky's, the greatest Fabergé experts and dealers in the world. What about the provenance? It stands up adequately? Is it possible that this emerald affair could have lain secreted somewhere in the Kremlin all these years? Certainly. The Kremlin treasure is vast. No one knows what they keep hidden. M drew on his pipe. So, in theory, there is no reason why this emerald ball should not have been unearthed from the Kremlin, furnished with a fake history to establish ownership, and transferred abroad as a reward to some friend of Russia for services rendered? None at all. It would be an ingenious method of rewarding the beneficiary without the danger of paying large sums into his or her bank account. But the final reward would depend on the auction price. What do you expect this object to fetch at Sotheby's? Wartsky's will certainly bid very high. Much would depend on how high they are forced up by an underbidder. Bond thought it was time to get Dr. Fanshawe out of the room so that they could get down to the professional aspects of this business. He got to his feet. He said to M, "Well, sir, I don't think there is anything else I need to know. It's very kind of Dr. Fanshawe to have gone to so much trouble." He turned to Fanshawe. "Would you care to have a staff car to take you wherever you're going?" "No, thank you very much. It would be pleasant to walk across the park." Hands were shaken, goodbyes said, and Bond showed the doctor out. Bond came back into the room. M had taken a bulky file stamped with the top secret red star out of a drawer and was already immersed in it. "Yes," he said. The blue eyes were bright with interest. "It fits all right. Interesting on two counts. First, it means that the KGB is totally hooked on the purple cipher or they wouldn't be making this fantastic payment. That's good news. It means that we can hot up the material we're passing over. Secondly, it explains something we've never been able to understand, that this girl hasn't hitherto received a single payment for her services. She had an account that only registered her monthly paycheck of £50. Now she's getting her payoff in one large lump sum." M reached for the ashtray made out of a 12-inch shell base and rapped out his pipe with the air of a man who has done a good afternoon's work. Bond shifted in his chair. There were some ragged edges to this problem, one particularly. He said mildly, "Have we ever caught up with her local control, sir? How does she get her instructions?" "Doesn't need to," said M impatiently. "Damn it, man, she's pouring the stuff into their lap 6 times a day. What sort of instructions would they need to give her? I doubt if the KGB men in London even know of her existence. Perhaps the resident director does, but as you know, we don't even know who he is. Give my eyes to find out." Bond suddenly had a flash of intuition. "It might be that this business at Sotheby's could show us who he is." "What the devil are you talking about, 007? Explain yourself." "Well, sir," Bond's voice was calm with certainty, "you remember what Fanshawe said about an underbidder, someone to make these Wartsky merchants go to their very top price. If the resident director is the only man who knows about this girl, he will be the only man who knows she's been paid. So he'll be the underbidder. We'll be able to identify him and have him sent home. He just won't know what's hit him. And resident directors don't grow on trees. It may be months before the KGB can appoint a replacement." M said thoughtfully, "Perhaps you've got something there." He swiveled his chair round and gazed out of the big window towards the jagged skyline of London. "All right, 007. I'll square things with 5. It's their territory, but it's our bird. There won't be any trouble. But don't get carried away and bid yourself. I haven't got the money to spare." Bond said, "No, sir." He got to his feet and went quickly out of the room. He didn't want M to change his mind. Wartsky has a modest frontage. The window gave no hint that these were the greatest Fabergé dealers in the world. Bond asked for Mr. Kenneth Snowman. A good-looking, very well-dressed man of about 40 came forward. Bond said quietly, "I'm from the CID. Can we have a talk?" The man smiled. "Come on downstairs." He led the way down into a large showroom. Gold and diamonds winked from lit cases. "Have a seat. Cigarette?" Bond took one of his own. "It's about this piece at Sotheby's tomorrow. We think there may be an attempt to raise the bidding artificially. We're interested in the underbidder. My job is to establish his identity." "Can't tell you any more, I'm afraid." Snowman's eyes glinted with enthusiasm. "Of course. Delighted to help in any way. But you know, it's not necessarily going to be all that easy. Peter Wilson, who'll be taking the sale, would be the only person who could tell us for sure. There are dozens of ways of bidding without making any movement at all. If the bidder fixes his method before the sale, Peter wouldn't think of letting anyone in on the code. That's a closed secret, as you can imagine, in the rooms." "I see," said Bond. "How do I get into the sale?" Snowman produced an elegant alligator skin note case and extracted two engraved bits of pasteboard. He handed one over. "That's my wife's. I'll get her one somewhere else in the rooms." Bond took the ticket. Snowman got up from his chair. "Would you care to see some Fabergé? It'll give you some idea what all the fuss is about." Later, dazzled by the diamonds, the multicoloured gold, James Bond walked up and out of the Aladdin's cave under Regent Street. Through the next day, Bond's excitement mounted. He found an excuse to go into the little room where Miss Maria Freudenstein and two assistants were working the cipher machines. He joked with the two junior girls, but Freudenstein only looked up to give him a polite smile. Bond's skin crawled minutely at this proximity to treachery. She was an unattractive girl with a pale, rather pimply skin, black hair, and a vaguely unwashed appearance. Such a girl would be unloved, have a grouse against society. Perhaps her only pleasure was the secret knowledge that she was, every day, hitting back. The revenge of the ugly duckling. By tonight, that girl would have made a fortune. But M said he was going to hot up the purple cipher operation. One false step, and the KGB would smell a rat. One more, and they would know they were being hoaxed. It would be assumed that Freudenstein had been working for the British as well as the Russians. She would inevitably and quickly be liquidated. Bond, looking out of the window across the trees in Regent's Park, shrugged. Thank God it was none of his business. The girl's fate wasn't in his hands. She was caught in the grimy machine of espionage.
Part 1 of The Property of a Lady by Ian Fleming was read by Damien Lewis and produced by Joanna Green. The executive producer was Liz Anstey, and it was a Senador production for BBC Radio 2. You can hear the concluding part at the same time next week.